Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday. Thoughtful Thursday is the day once a week when we have the opportunity to speak with an expert who provides us with a different view, an expanded view, a way to broaden our thoughts about a particular subject. Today is no different. I am very pleased to welcome back to Mind Talk Lisa Sue Wojtyc, who is the author of Unwelcome Heritance. And Lisa Sue is no stranger to the world of adult children of alcoholics. Her mother, Dr. Janet Wojtyc, was the early leader of the Adult Children of Alcoholics movement. And certainly, Lisa Sue, the concept, the thought of ACOA is throughout the population. It's probably in the dictionary as well. It's very much a part of our lexicon nowadays. Welcome, Lisa Sue, to Mind Talk. Lisa, talk about for a moment your experiences growing up with a mom who was absolutely a pioneer in the field of really understanding and working with adult children of alcoholics.
Sure. Well, my mom actually became that pioneer because she was so worried about her own children. And so because she could see what was happening to her own children living with active alcoholism, even though she was struggling herself, she was able to have that objectivity to the point where she feared that what was happening to us as children would affect us all throughout our lives. And so I think of myself as sort of that first control group in our home. And as my mother empowered herself to leave the marriage and to be able to stand on her own, she went back to school to become a therapist and took the things that she felt were happening, did research, validated her concerns through interviewing and surveying thousands of people. And what we found was that there were so many people having the similar struggle in their own homes. So what was going on in our home was going on in so many homes. And when my mom started writing, what she wrote really struck a chord. And here we are. So, and I was blessed to be part of that journey from the very beginning. What's so extraordinary to me is the way that she, in her own words, she would say she took her power back and she took her energy back and she used that to work on what she was passionate about. And it's just growing because the problems with substance abuse that we have today are only growing. And unfortunately, the treatment out there, I feel, is not able to catch up. But that's how it started. And it's been amazing.
It's been quite the journey. And again,
yes,
so much a part of our language nowadays that, you know, for many people, they almost can't remember a time when the concept of being an adult child of an alcoholic wasn't, you know, somewhere in the dialogue. Growing up in an alcoholic household, the children really are granted a quite unwelcome inheritance. Let's talk about some of the risk factors for children who experience a parent or a caregiver who, in fact, is struggling with alcoholism.
Sure. Well, in preparing for our conversation today, it occurs to me that there's more than one scenario. There's maybe a child whose primary caregiver has a substance abuse problem, and maybe that primary caregiver is the spouse or significant other of. And each of those scenarios is equally serious, but a little bit different. Because what happens with, say, for example, my mother, and you know, women, there are many, many women that are alcoholic or have addiction problems as men. I mean, the numbers, just take for granted that it's understood. The numbers are huge for everybody. But in my situation, for example, my mother was so preoccupied with my father's alcoholism that it affected her as a mother. And the scenario, if, say, for example, my mother had been the substance abuser, that would have been a whole different dynamic. So there are so many different nuances to this problem. The bottom line is that children that grow up in these circumstances, for a large part, end up taking on adult concerns and responsibilities at a very early age. And that exacts a price, a big price going forward, not just in childhood, but also throughout adulthood. So that's really one of my biggest concerns is, you know, when I hear about a child in kindergarten that had to get themselves ready for school in the morning and got themselves to the school bus because maybe their parent was hungover and couldn't get up, or, you know, their non-addictive parent, you know, the same scenario, just very preoccupied and not present for the children. So that's one of my biggest concerns, is these adult worries and responsibilities. Children that are in elementary school that know that they have to prepare their own meals and things like this, that they don't have a childhood. So that's one big concern that I have.
Well, and also for those children where the parent is struggling with his or her own alcoholic issues, that child can often wind up being, you know, in effect, the parent in the household, parenting their siblings, if there are any, as well as parenting their parents. Is there a different dynamic when both parents are consumed with alcohol?
Well, it's exponentially worse.
Okay.
Yes, because if there's a parent, I mean, in my situation, and I always use myself for an example because I'm just so one of many, so I may as well, you know, stand in my own shoes and share. But for example, I knew, even though my mother was a mess, I knew that she was there for me. I knew that she loved me. I knew that she was present in whatever way she could be. My father, though, was completely in his own thing, and, you know, not thinking about his children because he was preoccupied with his disease. So, and I remember as an adult having these conversations with my mother about how, knowing that, it didn't give me some sense of safety in this world that I wouldn't have had if I felt like both of my parents were just kind of spinning out there. So it does, as far as adding to consistency the children need in everyday life, at least I had a parent who was doing their best. But I want to, if you don't mind, if I could just interject, I feel that when I talk about this topic with people, that it sounds so depressing. I'm so hopeless, and I want to make sure that everybody knows that there's so much hope and there's so much to be gained. And my message is really about empowering parents to know that we can have an amazing positive impact on our children, everybody around us, that we can be that catalyst for change, and that we can change the legacy of our families going forward. So I just want to put that out there and make sure that people know by the end of our conversation, I want everybody to be smiling and know that we can do this.
Well, and you know, you I know it was a concern of your mother's as well, that people, once they identify themselves as being an adult child of an alcoholic, it almost becomes like, you know, their other arm or their other ear. It's just there for a lifetime, and that's the lens through which they forever see themselves. And so clearly what you're saying is you don't have to do that to yourself.
I feel very strongly that we have to stop doing that to ourselves, because there's a point at which, and I say this through decades of observations and feedback that I'm still getting from people, that when we stay on that story, we can't let go of it. And so we're kind of perpetuating that message, those feelings of failure and insecurity and et cetera. And in my writing, I'm trying to tell people, listen, let's take this to the next level, people. We're not victims. We have a whole life ahead of us. You know, let's take our power back. Let's do what we can do. I got a note from somebody the other day that told me that they've been in treatment for 20 or 30 years on medication, still struggling with these issues. And as you say, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. To me, that is unacceptable. I don't want people to stay in that story. It's counterproductive, and it's not necessary. We need to do whatever we can to get to a place where we can take our story, like my mom did, and like I'm doing to the best of my ability. We need to take that story and use it to move forward and to help other people, to do service, and to take our lives to the next level. Because as much as we've had struggles, we have capabilities that a lot of other people don't have.
Indeed.
You know, I mean, I feel like, and I grew up with a lot of violence. I had a tough childhood. But you know what? There's nothing that surprises me. And I land on my feet in very difficult situations. And, you know, I can be very independent sometimes to a fault, but those skills that I had to take on, those survival skills that I had to take on and learn very early, have served me well. So I believe in putting a positive spin on everything and using even the most difficult times to do good.
Well, and again, it changes your energy, even your physical energy within your body, when you're able to put a different perspective on it. I'm going to digress for half a second. You have to share the story of you in, I think you were in the seventh grade, and you decided to drive your dad's car.
Oh, gosh. My dad. There are so many stories of driving my dad's car. Were you
okay, I'm talking about the one where
five driving memories pop into my head.
I'm talking about the one where you got in the car and you kind of drove through the toll booths or something because you didn't
oh
even...
gosh. Yeah, well, I used to practice my driving in the middle of the night. That's how I got my practice, when everybody was asleep. Or my dad, I think in this story, my dad he parked his car right near the bus stop to work. He commuted into Manhattan every day. So I would, you know, I'd take his car for the day, maybe drive my friends down the shore. This is seventh grade. But anyway, I didn't know. I ended up on the Garden State Parkway somehow. I don't remember how. And I didn't have money, and I wasn't really sure what a toll booth was, so I just blew right through them. And I guess probably my parents got tickets in the mail or something. But so many stories like that. I remember another time where here I'm all 12 years old, and there was a boy I had, he was my first boyfriend, whatever that is, and his mother knew I was trouble, and she hated me. She just hated me. And one day, I'm just driving along down the street, and all of a sudden, she was walking out of a store, and our eyes met, and I saw this look of crazy alarm on her face. And later that evening, she called my house wanting to speak to my mother.
Uh-oh.
And, well, you know, I was already such a good liar by that point. I called my mother. She was at Montclair State College where she taught. And I said, can you believe this? This woman is after me. And let me tell you, when my, quote, boyfriend's mother reached my mother up one side and down the other, to leave her daughter alone, because I would lie and my mother would sign right onto it. So, yeah, all sorts of driving stories.
You really were a good liar.
So I'm a very good driver. So that's another skill I developed very early. So you can imagine what a great driver I might be.
I can also imagine that you might even want to dabble in politics with those kinds of skills.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. You were going to say.
I was just going to say, you know, it comes from learning, you know, early on how to lie on your feet, you know, because we have a lot to cover up. So it's just another, and that's something that really does backfire. And sometimes we lie for reasons later on. We find ourselves lying for reasons that really don't make any sense. We're afraid that other people are going to get angry at us, so we tell little white lies. Or, you know, we lie, like my mom writes about, when it would be just as easy to tell the truth. So that can be a habit to break, but it's just a habit, and it can be broken.
And is that one of the ways in which children who grow up in an alcoholic environment are impacted upon the ability to lie on their feet? Is that sort of a standard?
Absolutely.
Okay. What are some of
Absolutely.
The other almost standard ways that children learn to behave growing up in that kind of a household?
Well, you know, a child of an alcoholic is many times that child you see, the real compliant one that's getting straight A's, that seems to have that edge of sadness about them all the time, the one that's always looking to please. And then you'll have another extreme, the child that's really rebellious, you know, acting out all over the place. There are these extremes in behavior. And it's, I think it's obvious, I don't think you have to be a clinician to know that kids are trying to get attention any way they can, whether it's negative attention or positive attention. So it's really toward the same purpose, but those are some of the things that we did. I know that as a young child, I was that, you know, that student that, you know, the teacher would tell my mother, oh, I wish I had 30 of her in my class. But when that didn't work, a little later on, I started getting into other trouble because I figured if one tactic didn't work, maybe this will. And so then you'll see kids that are doing things like I did, driving, shoplifting, doing drugs very early. You know, we'll do what we need to do to get that attention.
To get that attention, which translates for a child into getting that love, getting that caring.
Right. And it doesn't matter. Like I said, it can be negative attention too.
Mm-hmm.
If my parents are preoccupied and they get mad at me, and they're yelling at me, I've gotten their attention. Just the same way as if I'm the perfect child and everybody says, look how wonderful she is. So, you know, since there's no consistency, you don't have a normal situation where on a daily basis, you know, children in a healthy family, you know, children are affirmed by their parents on some sort of regular, predictable basis. In our situation, since we're not, we begin to feel unworthy and unloved, and then we act that out. And I was doing some reading this morning. Even Erickson wrote about how from 3 to 6 years old, children are already capable of feeling shame. So,
Lisa, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to pick up right there because that really is a stunning statistic. It's a stunning piece of information. It's a stunning reality that from 3 to 6 children can be sort of steeped in a sense of shame. We will be right back. Folks, this is Dr. Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, and I'm having a conversation with Lisa Suwoidits, who is the author of Unwelcome Inheritance. And today we're talking about the impact of alcoholism on children and indeed on the family as a whole. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Lisa, talk about the experience of shame for children 3 to 6 years old. How does that show up? What does that look like?
It looks like a child that knows that his or her parents are unhappy, angry, sad, what have you, and they simply believe that it's their fault. And if I weren't such a rotten child. And, you know, and I know you and I have had, we had this part of this conversation the last time we spoke, where we talked about how children are so much more perceptive than we give them credit for, and that they understand so much more than we realize. And so even at that very young age, kids feel responsible for the reactions of their parents. So if my dad comes home and he's angry and violent, I feel like if I weren't such a rotten kid, my father would be happy. Or if I were a better child, my mother wouldn't be crying all the time, or et cetera. So that's where it begins. That's where it begins. And so I feel that as parents, even if we are in this situation, there are things that we can do, as long as we're aware. But that's how early it starts, and it's amazing. I find it fascinating and terrible at the same time to know that at these very, very young ages, things can happen that can impact us in a difficult way throughout our entire lives.
Well, you know, it's just stunning, really, to think about a little tiny thing, 3 years old, 4 years old. I mean, they're just tiny.
Yeah.
And to think that they are carrying on a burden that's about 100 times the size of their body weight is extraordinary.
Yes. That's such a great way of putting it. Yeah, it's true. I mean, I don't know how what age your earliest memory is. I can remember, I don't know, 4 years. I remember nursery school doing things, getting yelled at for doing things for other children that they should be doing for themselves, that kind of caretaker, wanting to be liked, you know, feeling that sort of way and feeling stressed out at home. I think anxiety in the household can impact a child even before three. That's just my opinion. I'm not a psychiatrist, you know. But I just remember, and I've spoken to so many people, that when there's that household, you walk in the door and you can cut the tension with a knife. I can't imagine how that could get past anybody of any age.
Well, and, you know, infants, you're absolutely right that infants can certainly be negatively impacted upon by that kind of stress and tension. I mean, you know, we talk a lot about attachment styles.
Right.
And they are so challenged when there's really nothing stable and secure and safe to attach to.
Right. And I've spoken to people that were infants with mothers that had not just substance abuse but also serious mental health issues and have no memory or memory of interacting with their mother in a way that they felt that connection that kids need to their mommy.
Mm-hmm.
It just was never there. And so that's a whole other, I mean, that's another ball of wax to go through your entire life never feeling connected to your mother. That's something I know. I can think of three people off the top of my head. One person, a male in his 50s. I know a woman in her 60s and another woman in their 70s, all struggling with that still, because when we look in our mother's eyes, we see their love for us reflected in their eyes. We get a sense of who we are. And that's one thing that my mom wrote about and that I wrote about, is that when we grow up in these difficult situations, we struggle with a lack of sense of ourselves. You know, it can manifest itself as something as little as that person that's always saying, "I don't know, what do you want to do?" Right. We don't even know what we think. We don't even know what our opinion is. We're looking for it from the outside.
And can actually get nervous and anxious if pressed to offer their own opinion or their own views.
Exactly. So, you know, that joke, you know, if I want your opinion, I'll tell you what it is. You know, that would have blighted this. That would have blighted this. So, and the last time you and I spoke, one of the things we talked about was, you know, how early is too early to talk to your children, to get kids into treatment. And I think the more that we think about it and talk about it, the more we see the earlier the better. And interventions can be different for, you know, different ages, but I know you wanted to talk about that later.
Well, we will talk about interventions later, but what I do want to speak to as you bring it up is, you know, the notion that certainly some parents have that, you know, my child couldn't possibly remember that, couldn't possibly have been impacted upon that. We don't even need to talk about that. Any number of things that children can experience. And parents somehow have this idea that, some parents, that before the age of, I don't know, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, everything's a blank and the child doesn't really remember anything and wasn't really impacted upon by anything. And if indeed the child doesn't remember, that child's been exposed to all kinds of trauma. And the exposure to the trauma allows them to sort of quote unquote forget what has actually happened. What about children who grow up in a household where perhaps there is no substance abuse among the parents, but the child has his or her own challenges, maybe ADHD, maybe any number of other things. And so the child begins to experiment with drugs and alcohol. How does that impact the family? Does that impact the family?
Well, my first thought is that chances are that this body chemistry is somewhere throughout the family. Maybe it skips a generation, or maybe it manifests itself in a different way in this particular generation that you're describing, where the parents don't have a problem. But when kids have issues, and we see this more and more as trying to help our kids that get addicted to substances, whether it's ADHD or mental health issues or substance abuse issues, the whole family is impacted, whoever that family member is. So if there are other siblings in the household, of course, they're not getting the parent's full attention, because the child that has the highest needs usually is the one that's kind of, I don't want to say absorbing, but in a sense, you know, getting the majority of the time and energy of that parent. You know, kids with ADHD, they're struggling at home. They have a different struggle in school. They have different struggles socially. So there's that same ripple effect. But my guess is that that these parents, if the child has ADHD, which has some basis in physiology, that there are other disorders running through the family. So you might have parents that maybe they don't have issues themselves, but maybe they were raised in an environment where they grew up with it. So they may be also reacting to their child based on their history. That's part of what Unwelcome Inheritance tries to unravel, those nuances for different people in different scenarios.
So there's no such thing as, I've got the problem and it's only my problem.
I don't think so, ever, no.
Ever.
Because we all impact other people.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we're a child, we all have impact on other people. It could be positive, it could be negative, but I feel that it's so important that we realize that we are, and the way that I talk about it is that we are the bridge between generations of our family. And we're also we can be a bridge between any people in our circle, but we do and have that impact on other people. So the more self-awareness we have, the more we can make that impact something great.
I just want to share, and I know you know this, but share with the audience from a list that your mom created. I take this from the Adult Children of Alcoholics, the expanded edition, in which she lists several of the kinds of experiences that adult children of alcoholics may experience. And tops on the list is the idea that adult children of alcoholics have to guess at what normal behavior is. And if you think about just that, that is such a stunning emotional, psychological experience to not really know what quote-unquote normal looks like.
We really don't. So since we don't have that sense of ourselves or what normal really is, again, we're looking to maybe other families, or we're taking a little bit from here and a little bit of there to try to figure that out. I know I did that as a kid. I had families whose homes that I loved to be in because I felt like, oh, this must be what a normal family is. And, you know, we just don't. So we look for it from the outside. And again, that has impact whether you're an adult in a job or whatever you're doing.
Right.
There's always this question of, am I doing it right? Am I doing it the way it's supposed to be done? Am I doing it the way somebody normal would do it? And that also goes to the notion that we're somehow broken and we need to be fixed.
And can never be fixed for some folks. I mean, that's the belief. That's not what we're saying is true, but we are saying that that's what many people believe. Your mother also speaks to the fact that adult children of alcoholics will judge themselves without mercy. I'll just go through the list very briefly.
Yeah, sure.
Have difficulty following a project from beginning to end. What's that about?
Right. Well, it's about growing up with a lot of inconsistency and chaos and a lack of an ability to plan. So an example that she always used was, you know, let's say your kid has a school project that they're supposed to do at home. Well, in my situation, I would probably complete that whole entire project the night before under a lot of pressure. Because chaos and anxiety are what gets me. That's my comfort zone. That's where I'm most productive. That's where I have the best focus. If you give me 6 months to do that same project, although, you know, I've come a long way, you know, but if I have an extended period of time to do that same project, there's much more of a chance that it won't get done. So it's this way of functioning, and also the lack of consistency. What home where the parents are substance abusers has regular meals with the family or regular outings or, you know, the major concern of what's going on with the children? Usually it's the other way around. The children are more preoccupied with taking care of parents than the parents are taking care of children. I have in front of me a list of, this is again a list out of a book my mom wrote that unfortunately she was too sick to really promote very well. But it's a book called Healthy Parenting. And in this book is a list really taken from the one you were just referring to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's applied to the healthy family. And what happens in a healthy family and what happens in an unhealthy family. And I can run through it quickly if you'd like.
That'd be great.
Okay, so in a healthy family, the job of the parents is to take care of the children. In an unhealthy family, the job of the children is to take care of the parents. In a healthy family, messages are clear and understood, and if they're not, they can be questioned. In an unhealthy family, there are double messages leading to confusion and guessing. Healthy family, the child is always loved, even if their behavior is unacceptable. In an unhealthy family, the child is shamed and the person is confused with the behavior, as in, you know, I'm not a bad person, I just did a bad thing. Then we talk about boundaries. Healthy families, the boundaries are respected. Unhealthy families, not the case. In a healthy family, all feelings are tolerated. In an unhealthy family, often feelings are violated or repressed. You can't express them at all. In a healthy family, the parent is a teacher and a guide. In an unhealthy family, the children raise themselves the best they can. We talk about reasonable limits in healthy families. and chaos and rigidity and unhealthy families. And I have three more, that the demands in a healthy family, the demands made on children are healthy and age appropriate, not the case in an unhealthy family. We talked about affirmation, and the planning piece, that in a healthy family, there's organization and planning and the ability to respond to crisis in a healthy way, as opposed to going from one crisis to the next.
I'd like for you to speak to the idea that children of alcoholics can be very loyal even in the face of no evidence, no support to actually make that loyalty make sense, but they will remain
right.
loyal. What's that about?
Right, and we pick these people too sometimes. I mean, we are drawn to these people. We're drawn to these people that resemble our parents. I mean, it's such a classic thing, but I think that we all do it. We are drawn, and this happens so many times in relationships. You know, oh, I married my father. Oh, I married my mother. We're drawn to these people, and we remain loyal to them, like my mom said, even in the face that the loyalty is undeserved. And that comes from wanting to win over the attention of somebody. The people that give us that unconditional love, boring. I remember, a couple of times throughout my life, a young man or older man, was interested in me, and they were consistent, and they treated me well, and every day they were basically the same. And I found that to be very boring. It's these crisis situations, that provide that kind of energy that somebody like me would feel more comfortable in. But it comes from wanting to win over that person. It comes from really a place of insecurity.
Right.
And as we get healthy, we learn that we don't need to do that. And those are probably those people that we feel like we would twist ourselves inside out to please, are probably people that we should walk away from.
And in fact, there are times when walking away from someone is not only healthy for you, it actually can be instructive for the person, but it can be healthy and life-saving for you. And I think about so many of the people who I've worked with who have found themselves in extraordinarily unhealthy relationships and find so much relief if and when they're finally able to pull themselves away from that much pain.
And you know what? Chances are we may gravitate again toward the very same dynamic in another person. So it's something to be aware of, and it's something to watch out for. Just, as we mature and as we realize that we deserve better, we'll be drawn to different people. And that boring person will really become appealing, hopefully.
Absolutely, and not quite so boring. All right, Lisa, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we've talked about many of the experiences that people may have who have grown up in these kinds of households. When we come back, I'd like for you to talk to us about what you believe are the appropriate approaches with regard to treatment for these individuals.
Okay.
Folks,
great.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue this conversation with Lisa Sue Woiditz, who is the author of Unwelcome Inheritance, and today talks to us in more detail about the impact of alcoholism on children and on families. We'll be right back. Teresa, so we, as I said earlier, we've been talking about the examples of behaviors that individuals living in an alcoholic household could experience. Tell us
right.
about what can be done to address these issues.
Okay.
What's going on now in the field of treatment, and what would you recommend might be a more powerful option?
Okay. Well, I just wanted to add one sort of stray thought that I had about the ADHD child.
Okay.
And that's coming from that healthy household or not. Many times, and I saw this a lot as a probation officer because I worked with high-risk youth, that kids with ADHD really learn to love marijuana. And so I just put that out there as something to watch for, because it just seems to give that condition a lot of relief and help the kids focus. However, as far as getting kids into treatment or getting them the help they need, the tricky thing is that obviously all children are dependent on their parents in some way to get them that help that they need. So right now I'm appealing to that parent that knows that things aren't right and they are worried about their child and maybe feel hopeless and overwhelmed. I think it's important to empower that parent to know that since they're the center of that child's universe, it really starts with them and their relationship. So in that vein, a couple of things. One is that we need to talk to our kids and affirm their feelings. Whatever age they are, we can talk to them at their level. If they express that they feel that they did something wrong, we need to tell them that they didn't, that they're beautiful and we love them and we're always there for them and we're going to keep them safe and get outside and have fun. Go to the park and just be fully present. I feel that it's very damaging to a child when their parents are preoccupied. And I remember times when I was, during my first divorce, I've been divorced twice, and when I got divorced the first time, my kids were 3 and 4 years old. And I had so much weight on my shoulders trying to put food on the table for them that I forgot about being fully present for them. And I was exhausted all the time, always looking for a break, just like my mother was. And when I had that realization, I just decided, you know what, there's no break, Lisa. There's no break. Roll up your sleeves, get in there, play with the kids. That's what life's all about. Be there, give them your 100% undivided attention so that when you tell them that you love them and that you're there for them, you really are. You're actively loving them and actively caring for them, because parenting is a verb. So that's the primary relationship, and there's so much that we can do to help that grow, even in the face of whatever we're living with.
The other piece that I would add to that, that so often parents may not realize, is how important they really are to their children. And if a parent is dealing with his or her own sense of depression and low self-esteem, it can be hard to imagine that they're important to anybody, let alone their children.
Right.
But in fact, they are. And that's so important to remember.
We have to do it. And most parents will say, for myself, I don't even care about getting out of bed in the morning. But for my kids, I'll do anything. And that's been my motivation through so many tough times. You know, my lowest times where I felt, you know, like where my self-confidence was in the toilet, and I'd say, you know what, for my kids, I'm going to rally. For my kids, I'll do anything. And I also remember my mom explaining to me that my father was sick. And, you know, where you might think, well, sick is lying in bed with a thermometer sticking out of your mouth or something like that, In my case, sick was my father passed out on the living room floor. It was sick. It made sense to my little mind, even though maybe at 4 years old, I didn't understand the disease of alcoholism. The fact that he was sick made sense to me. So we can explain on their level. We can validate, yes, there's something wrong. Mom's sick. Dad's sick. And we want them to get well, but we're okay. So that's the primary.
Is there ever a time when, let's say, an adolescent should reasonably be considered for inpatient treatment?
Well, yes, definitely. And we see that happening more and more. Unfortunately, insurance pays less and less.
Yeah.
So kids are getting less and less. But I have seen in more recent years kids acting out mental health issues, hospitalized for mental health issues, cutting, bipolar, just all over the map. So definitely, and it's fact that kids are using serious drugs earlier and earlier. I grew up in a time where, as we talked about before, I was in preteen, which doesn't exist anymore, but it was for younger kids. There was Al-Anon for the mom or dad, a spouse or significant other of the alcoholic. Then there was Alateen for the teenagers, and this is back in the 70s. There was preteen for the little itty bitties, and I was in at that time. And when I got into Alateen, and me and my friend started drinking and drugging, the parents that had been in AA and Al-Anon for several years at that point, they threw their kids right into treatment. I had friends going through rehab at 15 years old. And they stayed sober. I have friends that are now in their 50s that have 35 years sobriety. So
that's huge.
And a lot of them don't see that so much today, but with the right treatment as early as possible and the support afterwards, I think we can do it. But it's a lot of work, but I think we can do it.
What do you think is the right treatment for, let's say, a 12-year-old, 10, 12, 15-year-old child?
Okay. Treatment, you mean inpatient treatment?
Treatment period, inpatient,
or
outpatient.
Treatment period.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, like I keep saying, it begins at home. But if we're rising to the level where we need something more serious than that, the problem is there's really not a lot out there. There are more outpatient options for kids at that age than anything else I see. Certainly, Alateen is still out there. There's not a lot of it, but I would go there. I would get in touch with Hazleton. They've got resources all over the country. And I would also, if we're talking mental health, and they're always intertwined, mental health and substance abuse. You never really know which is first, the chicken or the egg.
Right.
But as far as mental health concerns, I would contact NAMI, which is the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. They've got an amazing website, and they have educational programs and support groups all over the country, too. Those would be my first go-to. But as far as, say, therapy, I would be I'm very cynical when it comes to therapists, because I grew up in the biz, and I've seen a lot of help, and I've seen a lot of harm done, and I would be very, very careful about picking providers for my kids or for anybody, but especially for kids. Sometimes schools have good groups. I know they're where I live, there are groups for kids of divorced parents, and so there's usually some kind of problem from, going on at home if parents are divorced. Here they call it banana splits. It's an opportunity for just kids to be with each other. And the beauty of that, which I experienced in preteen and Alateen, is that even with words unspoken, there's this understanding and this comfort of knowing that you're with kids that see what you see, that feel what you feel. I had a close friend of mine from Alatina, actually, that I'm recently in touch with again. And she said, you know, she said, it's so funny because I didn't know this about you. And it made me realize that back then when we were together all the time, we really didn't even know these little things about each other because it was so irrelevant.
Interesting.
So community is really, I can't emphasize enough how important that is. Treatment, though, very, you know, I would really do a lot of homework. And, you know, just because you hear somebody works with kids doesn't mean they're the right person.
And it doesn't mean that they know how to work with children who are dealing with substance abuse issues or in a household where there's substance abuse.
Yes. And but my mom, actually, she used to emphasize this all the time, that especially in working with children from alcoholic homes, which, by the way, the same dynamics apply. It doesn't matter what the addiction is, or even if it's ultra-religious or gambling or, you know, so many different scenarios. You know, we can apply this learning to so many different situations. But as far as substance abuse is concerned, I remember my mom always saying, you need to find somebody who is trained and understands what it means to come from this family. Because the expectations are different. If you're the child of an alcoholic, and you're working with a therapist that doesn't understand what that's all about, then they're not going to be able to help you get past, you know, the low self-esteem consequences that you're living through. And they may have expectations and may try to encourage you in ways that you can't do.
And may not really,
you know, it can be harmful.
Really may not understand the nuances. Certainly around people pleasing and beginnings and endings. I mean, there are so many nuances to that experience that they may or may not be able to see.
Exactly. It's just a point of, you know, very carefully picking these providers and, you know, looking at what kind of training they have and, you know, really getting into detail about that.
Which for many people feels difficult to do. I mean, there's more and more information nowadays about everybody on the web, certainly. But, you know, there's still folks who have a hard time with actually asking their mental or medical health professional, what was your training? You know, what do you know about? What do you not know about?
Right. And we trust the wrong people. We trust the wrong people. So if we're really taking care of ourselves and we're taking care of our kids, then it really makes sense. And, you know, the field of coaching is also opening up. Now, that's different than therapy.
Right.
Therapy is talking about, you know, sorting out the past issues. And coaching is, you know, more about moving forward. So depending on where you're at, you know, maybe somebody who can help you just take those steps forward, you know, maybe that's where you're at too. There's a lot of help out there and different things work for different people. But when we're talking about the little kids, you know, that parent that is present, that could be more present, which is great for the parent too, by the way. When I had that epiphany and I decided, you know what, there's no break. Why would I want to break from this? This is why I'm here. I'm spending so much time worrying about how am I going to take care of my kids that they're right here and I'm not giving them what they need.
Interesting.
So, yeah. So we go, you know, we start there and we move out into our community. And, you know, if we can just kind of keep track of where our kids at and when we know, parents know when there's something really wrong with our kids and with ourselves too. If we follow that through, don't minimize it like we tend to do,
right?
Which I did all the time. I grew up in a household where we minimize problems. Like, a problem isn't a problem unless we need an ambulance. You know, that's, to me, that's what I grew up knowing a problem was. as a parent now all these years later, and as somebody who's been working on my own personal growth for all these years, now I know if I get that little feeling inside, that's a problem. So we need to learn to address problems as soon as we can, not to minimize them until they become a crisis, because that's the way we used to do it. We don't need to do that.
Exactly.
We can trust our instincts.
Lisa Sue Wojtyc, it is always a pleasure to talk to you, and you're always just able to offer such important, really critical information to our listeners. So once again, I thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk.
Thanks so much for having me. Thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a licensed medical or mental health professional. Mind Talk is available on demand by going to myndtalk.org, and then you can download any conversation that you've heard at your leisure. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me, the best way is to send an email to pamela@mindtalk.org. That's P-A-M-E-L-A at myndtalk.org. And folks, you remember, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.